Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to the International Webcast, sponsored by the LaRouche in 2004 campaign. The topics this afternoon will particularly center on the crisis in Southwest Asia, otherwise known as the Middle East, and the onrushing financial global crisis. And without further ado, please welcome Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed. Thank you. Deborah Friedman. Well, oh, here she is. Deborah, I've just been announced by Ed. Okay. This is going to be very hard stuff. It has to go out. It will go out naturally over the web network. Because we're at a very serious point of crisis, and virtually no one who is in ostensibly leading positions as a candidate or incumbent president or so forth in the United States is qualified at all even to think about what's in front of us, let alone deal with it. Kerry, a guy who I don't dislike, who's got certain qualifications, but he's frankly been a disaster on the issue of the Southwest Asia, the Iraq crisis, and on the economy. President Bush, I don't know where he is. I don't think he knows where he is sometimes, even where he's sitting. We have a mess. The problem today is, right this moment, you've probably noticed some of the data coming out of Europe. The financial crisis has reached a point of maturity, which I'm not surprised by, but it's happening. The system is breaking down. It is crumbling. We do not have yet a collapse in the full sense of the term, but we have a process of crumbling around the world, today, yesterday, and so forth, which is extremely ominous. There are some people who've been talking about postponing the crisis until after the November elections. That will not happen. That we can be sure. The crisis is here. It cannot be postponed. This is May. You're not going to postpone this crisis until November. It's coming on. It probably is coming on before the summer arrives. And no one in the United States in a position of leadership. There's some people in the woodwork, there's some people who are staff people, some people in government, would be prepared to act appropriately. But we don't have a president, or we don't have a leading candidate for president, in the form of Kerry, who is qualified emotionally or intellectually to do the things that are absolutely indispensable without compromise to deal with, first of all, the monetary financial crisis, the economic crisis, or to deal with the situation in Iraq. They simply, I can guarantee you, neither of them, the White House nor Kerry, as long as they're advised by the people who are advising him now, will do anything that is even approximately intelligent about the issue in Iraq, the region generally, or about the economic situation. It's just not going to happen. I have made a proposal on this question of Southwest Asia, which will work. A number of people from various countries around the world, leading people, have proposed that I take certain things into account. Some of them will probably, in the question and answer today, will pose those questions to me, and I shall respond to you, to them. But I can assure you that there can be no compromises with what I have proposed. I've not proposed too much. I've proposed a minimal approach to getting the situation in Iraq and adjoining countries under control. People think that this is a matter of negotiating a contract. People are trying to put their 2 cents in a sense, as we say here, to their condition. Forget it. Forget contracts. What we need for the area there is we need a form of agreement which follows precisely the guidelines of the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, which brought a long period of religious warfare to an end. We're now dealing with an area which has been reduced to religious warfare and to related conflicts in the Middle East, as it's called. You are not going to deal with that kind of situation by making a contract agreement, like a bunch of dumb lawyers, Washington lawyers, coming in and trying to bargain points. Don't try to do this the way that President Clinton goofed the negotiation at Camp David on Israeli-Palestinian peace. Get that out of your mind. It is not going to work. As a matter of fact, there is going to be no solution for the crisis in Southwest Asia unless we can adopt it as my doctrine by name. Because nobody else has the credibility to do what has to be done. That is, no candidate, no other spokesman for the United States has the credibility to make that proffer, and no one can be trusted to carry it through. The same thing is true on the question of the economic crisis. No one in the United States, in a leading position, apart from my leading position, is prepared to even consider doing the absolute minimal things that have to be done to prevent this nation and much of the nations of the world from collapsing into a deeper depression, far deeper, far worse than 1929-33. It's coming on now. Now, the problem is that I blocked out of official discussion with whole channels of people who should be talking to me about precisely these questions. I have the expertise, I have the qualifications, they don't. If they're serious about saving the country and dealing with the problem, they would talk with me. Why don't they talk? Well, some of them do in indirect ways. But they don't talk directly. We don't get into a dialogue. What does that mean? There are people in the system, certain financier interests in particular, people typified by Lazard Freer, typified by Rohatyn, and similar types, whose approach to the world financial crisis today is to follow the guidelines that were carried out by the man who put Hitler into power in Germany, Hjalmar Schacht. What is being proposed, as you see, in the imposition of conditionalities upon Argentina, the new ones, the so-called voucher funds, are exactly a forecast of what these people intend to do to the people of the United States as well as other countries as this crisis becomes worse. Everything will be cut except the interest payments to the bankers, as was done by Schacht and company over the period 1929-33 in response to the onrush of what had known to be at that time as an onrushing general world depression. People will die if these bankers have their way. These bankers and the interests they are associated with control the Republican and Democratic Party election machines. They are presently controlling Senator Kerry. They control the people who, on whose lap President Bush sits to take orders. These people are determined to keep me out of the situation because they know what my message is. My message is to follow the precedent of Franklin Roosevelt's dealing with the World Depression, both in his election campaign in 1932 and in his presidency from March 1933 on. My commitment is to say that the government is not efficient or morally competent unless we are able to carry out the instruction of the preamble of our Constitution to defend the sovereignty of our nation, to defend the general welfare of all of our people, and to promote the security and welfare of our posterity. Those are the three requirements of the President of the United States above all. None of the candidates I'm dealing with in the United States or their circles are prepared to accept that. As a matter of fact, that means that if I'm president and the crash hits with full force, or it has hit, I am going to do pretty much what Franklin Roosevelt did. I'm going to put the bankrupt system into bankruptcy reorganization to keep everything functioning that must function for our people, for our security, and for growth. And that means the bankers are going to have to take a back seat. They're going to have to get in line like everybody else. The people of the United States come first. And the test of the quality of a president of the United States for a situation like this is to look at the people who are the poorest. who are the least privileged. And if you can't do something for them, you're not going to do something for the nation. We have a very sick nation politically right now. Over the period since 1977, you'll observe that there has been a decline in the physical standard of living of people in the lower 80% of family income brackets. Politics has more and more been turned over to a smaller section of the population, the upper 20%, which some call the suburban stratum. The older people who are now in their 50s and 60s, who are generally running most of the places in the country, who control the Democratic Party machines, who think in terms of the interests of the baby boomer generation, with their fantasy life, with their comfort zones, and that sort of thing. Not the future. And therefore, this generation will not, of its own accord, respond on its own initiative appropriately to this situation. The United States, which has the oldest constitution surviving on this planet today, and it's the oldest because it's the best. But if we fail that constitution in a time of crisis, now, we won't have a constitution. We won't have a nation. So the test has come, can we do it now? And the decision must not lie with the upper 20% of family income brackets. The decision must not lie with the bankers who would like to impose the Shaktian methods used by the man who put Hitler into power, Yalmar Schacht, against the United States and other nations today. The people who would enforce the collection procedure against Argentina, even if it means mass murder. The people who are cutting the health care of senior citizens because they think we have too many of them and doing more and more each time. They're reclassifying prescription drugs as over-the-counter drugs so the insurance companies won't have to support your prescriptions. This is the kind of thing that's going on, and nobody's doing anything in government effectively to stop it. So therefore, the question is, will the people of the United States stop waiting to be bought to vote? Will they stop waiting until they get approval to vote? Will the people of the United States, the 80% in the lower family income brackets, mobilize themselves to say, we are the majority in this country? We are the ones whose requirements have to be met. We are going to turn out to vote whether you pay us to go to the polls or not. We are going to vote the way we think our interests determine, the interests of our country. We are going to go, we're going to throw you bums out who will not pay any attention to our concerns. And the people need a candidate like Roosevelt who will say to the forgotten man and woman of our country, have courage, come out and vote, I'm your man. That's the only way we're going to deal with this depression. It's the only way we're going to deal with the situation in the Southwest Asia, including Iraq. Don't believe that the United Nations will step in to save the situation in Iraq. It will not. Forget it. Don't say, go to the United Nations and give them the power. They can't do it and won't do it. Kofi Annan may have the intention to do something, but he doesn't have the power to do anything. He does not have the resources to do what's required. I do. Because I think I can have the resources of the people of Iraq as well to help us get out of this mess. Don't think that somebody in Europe is going to stop this. Don't think that someone in Europe is going to come to the rescue of the international financial and monetary system. They won't. There's no one there with the guts to do it in a leading position of power. Their culture says don't do it. European culture is based on the British system of independent central banking systems. They will not overturn the principle of independent central banking systems. They're not capable of doing it constitutionally. The only way Europe could do that is on the initiative of the United States government. As we bailed Europe out at the end of World War II, with a Bretton Woods system which was backed by the U.S. dollar and backed by the design provided by Roosevelt in the 1944 Bretton Woods agreements. Those are the only ways that this world is going to be put in shape. No one else can do it except the United States, because there's no authority outside the United States which is both competent and willing to do it. We have to do it. We have to mobilize our country. Don't try to find an alternative. It doesn't exist. Either we as a nation get back on our feet and meet our responsibilities, or there isn't anything for this planet except the threat of a dark age. I'll give you some indication of what the problem is, a historical indication. Some of you are not old enough to have had the experience that I've had. A couple of people in the room will do, but that's about it. The experience is coming out of the Depression and the Second World War, coming back from military service to the United States, and finding that the people who we had fought against, the people behind Hitler, were coming back into power in the United Kingdom and the United States. It was a right-wing turn in which most of the people of my generation capitulated. They capitulated out of cowardice. Even people who had fought in war suddenly showed cowardice and capitulated to fear of the right wing, to fear of the FBI, to fear of what the Truman administration represented. We were somewhat saved from the evils of Trumanism by the Eisenhower election. And 2 terms of Eisenhower gave a period of relative stability and security in the country, some relief from the right-wing ravaging that was going on. This turned many people who themselves of my generation were cowards. They fled into suburbia. They went for tech jobs in classified employment, that is, security classified employment. They saw jobs as engineers and technicians and so forth. They were determined to become rich in suburbia and forget the poor behind them. They raised their children, their pretty children, to things like funny schools you saw on television. And the children were told, don't tell the truth. Be careful what you say. Your father might lose his job. Don't express opinions which contradict those of your teachers. You might get the family into trouble. So what happened is that the generation which was born in the post-war period and came to young adulthood in the middle of the 1960s were trained to be sophists. Not to believe in truth, but to believe in being overheard saying something that was advantageous to your career. So then we were hit with a missile crisis. Everybody found God in a beer can for about 4 or 5 days. They were convinced we were going to all be fried. Thermonuclear weapons, the missiles were going to come in on us, on the Soviet Union, on Europe, and so forth. We were all going to be fried. There was this famous novel out of Australia by Neville Shute called On the Beach, where the last people were dying of radioactivity, the last people on the planet, where the radioactivity finally overtook them. That was the state of affairs. You had messes in Europe, but you had also the assassination of Kennedy. All of these things were done by the right wing, a right wing today typified by Vice President Cheney. They did it to us. People who were the so-called baby boomers, the children who had been taught to become sophists during the 1950s, who didn't believe in truth, who believed in what is advantageous to be overheard believing, the people who are controlled by polls. The latest poll was supposed to tell you what to believe. Say, I don't know what to believe today. I haven't seen the poll yet. This was the kind of society. And therefore, we trained a baby generation to flee from what they didn't have the courage to remember. And the right wing took over. It really took over with the Vietnam War, the Indochina War. It took over with Nixon. Nixon in 1966 met with the Ku Klux Klan in Biloxi, Mississippi, and that was called the Southern Strategy. Bit by bit, Democrats of that Southern Strategy inclination left the Democratic Party and went over to the Republican Party, or who knows where. 1971-72, we destroyed the world economy. We started by George Shultz as an advisor, indirectly, but an advisor then to Nixon, who shut down the monetary system that had saved us in the post-war period. 1972, Shultz at the Azores Conference was the key negotiator who set up the floating exchange rate system, which has plunged the world as a whole into the present financial crisis, and so forth and so on. So we've been in that kind of process. Now you have, what does Cheney represent? Cheney represents what he says he represents, what he said he represented in 1989 to 1992, when he was Secretary of Defense under George Bush the First. He said he was for perpetual war. He said he was for preventive nuclear war with mini nukes, that is, low radioactive yield but high potential bombs, missiles. He tried to get it through. At that time, people said no. He was checked. He kept on with his program, the extreme right-wing program today. The policy of the United States under a Cheney administration, which is what you have. You don't have a Bush administration. You have a Cheney administration. You have a dummy sitting on the knee of a Vice President Cheney who's controlled by strings from his wife, who is worse than Cheney is, worse than he is. She's the clever one. He's the dumb brute who's holding the strings on the president, the marionette. So what we have today is a commitment that if Cheney were reelected as vice president, we are looking at not an Iraq war, not a mess in Afghanistan, which is getting worse by the day. We are looking at a war attack on Syria, an attack on Iran, nuclear weapons thrown at North Korea, eventually a war against China. We're looking at that kind of world, a world which is depressed by a great financial crisis, worse than that of the 1930s. That kind of condition. These are the preconditions for a dark age. And my problem is, I'm looking at our people, our nation. I recognize the responsibility we have as a nation for the sake of humanity as a whole. Once again, as under Roosevelt, the job has come to us. We must provide the decisive margin of leadership to save the world from hell, the kind of hell that Hitler represented back then. We have to do it again. And as far as I can see, looking around me, among my so-called rivals for the presidency and others, I see no one with the competence or guts to do the job. I also see in American people the lower 80% of the family income brackets of this nation, unwilling to get out and fight for themselves. They no longer believe in voting. You get 15 to 20% turnout in votes, elections, in districts. What does that tell you about the American people? They don't have no confidence that their vote means anything. They vote if they're paid to turn out. They turn out for local issues, not for national issues, not for issues on which the fate of the nation is dependent. Therefore, my job and your job is to help me change that. Under Kerry, under Bush, at present, maybe we can change Kerry. I certainly am trying to do it. If he's nominated, we've got to do something with him, and I've got to do it. But if we don't make those changes, we don't get the average voter out to fight for his or her own vital interest for this nation. This nation is not going to make it, and the world's not going to make it. All human beings will be around, but we're going to go through some special kind of hell. Because the time came when the responsibility was passed to us, and there were not enough people there to respond, to save the nation. People, you know, people ask me, say, what chance do you have of being elected? I said, I have a better chance of being elected than you have of surviving if I'm not. And that's a fact. It's not an exaggeration. Those are realities. But the baby boomer says, no, no, it's not like that. We have our comfort zones. Our comfort zones say that what you say will not exist. Our comfort zones say there will be no financial crisis. There will be difficulties, of course, but we will manage them. Yes, we are not going to pull out of Iraq. We are not going to announce our military operations against the Iraqi people as over, as ceased. We're not going to do that. We're going to come up with something. We're going to rearrange the chairs. But this is not a real crisis that we have to take a sudden action on. We're not going to say things that George Bush would call unpatriotic, and he's not even a patriot. He doesn't know what patriotism is. Wouldn't understand the word. So that's the situation. We're faced with that kind of problem. And if we cannot mobilize enough people in this nation, not because they got permission from the polls, not because they bought to go out to the polls, not because the Washington Post tells them it's all right to vote for me, or something like that. If they cannot stand up on their own hind legs and fight for themselves and do the thing that can work in fighting for themselves, is making sure they don't choose people on what the pollsters say, but they choose people on what those people are going to do to solve the problems that this nation has. It is not just all the little things that count. Yes, there are many little things that need to be fixed. And I've addressed many of them in the course of this campaign. But the essential thing, are you willing to save the human race from what threatens it now? What threatens it now are not the local issues. What threatens us are the local issues. We don't have the means to deal with the local issues. We don't have the willingness to deal with them. What threatens us, we lack the will at the top to take the kind of decision which will lead the world out of this mess. If the United States were to follow my leadership, we would have support that we need from Europe. The United Nations would play a role which we would assist giving it in the matter of Iraq. We would find a way to deal with this world financial crisis. I know how to deal with it. These things, these are the decisions that have to be made, and they have to be made here in the United States, first of all, because no other part of the world is capable of making the decision on its own to do the job if we don't do it. The world depends upon the United States with all of the faults we've acquired. We have the oldest constitution on this planet, and that is not an accident. It's the oldest because it's the best. It's the constitution that worked when every other part of the world failed. And if we stick to that tested constitution and use the executive branch of government as the executive branch was intended to be used when this constitution was framed, if we pride the leadership which the Europeans who helped make us possible intended, when they intended to create in this country, on this continent, a new nation, which would be a beacon for freedom for the rest of the world, for similar kinds of republics. That never happened. The French Revolution, other things prevented it. There were improvements in Europe, so forth. But the kind of nation which we were constituted to become, which the greatest Europeans who support us intended we should become, no other nation on this planet has acquired that kind of constitutional character. We, with all our faults, still have that. The President of the United States, if he's competent and understands that, is capable of leading the American people to inspire other people in other parts of the world, not to become part of an American empire, but to cooperate with us in finding solutions to the problems that face us now. And there are solutions. The question is, that willingness exists to apply those solutions. This must come from the United States. It must come from the leadership of the United States. And I'm saying to the world right now, via this broadcast, this webcast, and otherwise, you better turn to me, buddy, because this is your last shot. If I go, you don't have anything else that's capable of leading the United States in a fighting position now. And if we don't have somebody in a leading position in the United States, in the presidency, who's steering this country's leading role in the world, there's no hope for Europe. There's no hope for the United Nations or from it. And there's no hope for the world at large. This planet is on the verge of going into a new dark age. We don't have to go there. It's not inevitable. We have a choice. But if we don't provide the leadership from the United States to get the rest of the world to move in the necessary direction, there is going to be a dark age for all humanity. And that we could discuss. Okay.
Good afternoon. I should tell people that in the less than 2 weeks since Mr. LaRouche issued the LaRouche Doctrine, we see the response globally, and I think that the response is indicative of the depth and the nature of the crisis. In some respects, more than half of what Mr. LaRouche has recommended in that doctrine is already underway in terms of being implemented. But I think that the one point, which is the most compelling issue in all of this, is that it will not work without Mr. LaRouche's personality. And one of the things that we are engaged in, both here in the United States and internationally, is pulling together the kind of team around Mr. LaRouche that can see to it that that policy is implemented in his name now, because that is, in fact, what history demands. Over 500,000 copies of the LaRouche Doctrine are now in circulation in the United States in English. It is also now been translated into 6 other languages. Over the course of the last week, Mr. LaRouche's comments on this have been widely publicized, particularly throughout the Arab world. Today, the LaRouche Doctrine, or at least a first serialization of the LaRouche Doctrine, appears in Al Arab magazine, which is Al Arab newspaper, which is published out of London. Yesterday, Mr. LaRouche was featured on the website Islam Today. Over the course of the last several days, numerous leading personalities in the Arab world have come out and endorsed Mr. LaRouche's efforts in this regard. But we still have a great deal of work to do. And it is our hope that by bringing this webcast online today and by bringing Mr. LaRouche's comments before the American people, that we can actually begin to shift the geometry inside the United States, particularly around certain leading figures. We will be taking questions from the audience gathered here. We also are taking questions via the internet. If people have questions, please do submit them. For those of you gathered here, if you have questions, Angela Vullo, who is one of the people on our staff, has index cards. I would ask you to simply identify yourself by name and by association if you would like to. You do not have to write out your question. If you'd like to come up to the microphone and ask your question, that's fine. If you'd like me to ask the question for you, that is also quite okay. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to entertain a few questions that have come in from the Arab world via the internet and give Mr. LaRouche the opportunity to answer them. Then the first question comes from Maria Malouf, who is from NTV, which is a TV station based in Lebanon. She says, Mr. LaRouche, you call for all American military forces to be withdrawn immediately in your doctrine. But on November 28, 2003, you called for the ceasing of the U.S. military occupation at the earliest possible occasion. What exactly are we dealing with here? 1 year? 2 years? What is the time frame we can expect for withdrawal?
As I have said, this has to be called the LaRouche Doctrine. Now, that means that the United States has to accept the doctrine as I've defined it, not try to build a contract by negotiating away the doctrine with conditionalities. That means they accept it. Now, what happens if the U.S. government accepts it? Because this is not an if question. This is a question of concrete action. And it's the kind of action which is not a parliamentary decision. It's a decision by the executive branch of the United States government, is what I'm demanding. Yeah? I'm demanding the pressure on the United States government from all kinds of sources to induce that man who occupies the White House today, with all his, shall we say, shortcomings, and lack of anything else, to make a decision under pressure which will say that the LaRouche Doctrine for Southwest Asia is, by executive order, is U.S. policy. That's what I'm demanding. That's the only thing that will guarantee the kind of solution toward which I've aimed. Now, if that is the case, what happens then? If my Arab friends and others, when relevant in this, concur that that is the doctrine they want to mobilize their own countries and people around, then we've got an action. That means that several things will immediately follow, not months or years down the line, but immediately. An agreement with relevant forces in Iraq for a disengagement of U.S. forces from conflict with any part of the Iraqi population. This means the immediate withdrawal of U.S. military forces into designated bases. Right? That's the withdrawal from Iraq. The withdrawal of U.S. forces from continued active military engagement. And if nobody comes in there to shoot at them, they're not going to shoot back. That's the first step. Now, the second step is to, in that, as I've indicated, is to say we decide that we want the United Nations to be a responsible agency for supervising this area while we're trying to get Iraq reconstructed. This means that the Ba'ath Party officials, except for some people who may be objectionable to all concerned, will come back into full functioning. They should never stop functioning. And civilian authorities in Iraq, which were functioning, unless they have some objectionable thing about them personally, which all parties agree on, they come back to their jobs. That means we now have some hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who are now working to carry out the reconstruction of their own country. Our job, the United States, is to cooperate to ensure that that reconstruction is successful. We recognize, of course, the right of Iraq to build a military force and rebuild it as a capable defense capability for the nation of Iraq. And in other words, we've got to give them back their country the way it should have been done at the end of the so-called first hostilities, their country. This will only work if other things are done at the same time. Remember, this is executive decision of the United States government. It is not a parliamentary decision. It means the Congress is going to have to second it. And I defy any congressman or any significant one of them to defy this thing at this point. This thing in Iraq is very unpopular. And any congressman with guts is going to say, yes, you're getting us out of there? Good. Servicemen, general officers, others, retired and serving, you're going to say, good. Get us out of there. You say, what are you going to do with the military? I say, I'm going to rebuild it in the United States. As a defense force and a reconstruction force, as an engineering force, we'll rebuild the military. We don't want a disgrace, as called the military. The senior officers don't want a disgrace. They'll do a good job. Don't worry. That means that we have to have a kind of agreement among the nations of the region, which ensures that a peace, once achieved, will be stable. And peace could be had right away. If forces in Iraq agree, and this means, of course, Sistani and company, have to be brought into the picture. Eh? You've got to unite the Iraqi people about the rebuilding of their own country. And they have to reunite themselves. We can't do it from the outside. We've had enough of Bremer and his ideas. Eh? That means we have to have an agreement with the region, as I've laid out. You must finally say that Southwest Asia, not the Middle East, that's a British colonial term. Southwest Asia is dominated by Arabs, but it's not entirely Arab. This area has to have its own policy. It's a weak point in the entire reconstruction and rebuilding of Asia as a whole, Eurasia as a whole. We can't have this kind of cockpit there anymore. The people don't want it. The people are terrified, fears of loss of security and so forth in the region. But they have to make an agreement. So therefore we say, what kind of agreement? We have one experience which worked. It worked in 1648. And remember, from about 1511 to 1648, Europe was almost bled to death by religious warfare, orchestrated by those who were trying to maintain and go back to the old feudal system. This was led by the Spanish and Austrian Habsburgs, but also by the Venetian bankers. And Europe was torn in orchestrated religious wars, organized largely by Venice, the Venetian bankers, and led by Spanish troops. That was one of the greatest crimes against humanity. You want to talk about anti-Semitism? Talk about Tomás Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor, an anti-Semite who wanted to kill every Jew. Hitler was simply a copy of that. So this kind of thing was going on until 1648, when Cardinal Mazarin from France, who had been the Pope's peace negotiator earlier, led in reaching an agreement among the powers called the Treaty of Westphalia, which the agreement was based on giving the advantage to the other by agreement. That is, no decision shall be made which is contrary to providing a benefit to the other nation or the other people. And therefore, to establish a community of commonality of interest based not on saying, what do I want from them? I will give them what they need, and I expect them to do the same for me. We have to have that kind of peace in the Middle East. We have a long period of religious warfare and similar kinds of warfare throughout the region. A warfare which has been going back to the time of the Ottoman Empire and earlier. The British have been in there since the beginning of the 19th century, running wars, managing the area by getting people to shoot each other within the area, this kind of thing. You have the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which has been going on for a long time. You can't get peace by negotiating by contract terms under those conditions. You have to bring to bear a principle which will bring about peace. You have to use the very shock of the horror which people have gone through, the insecurity, the nightmare, to say, do you finally want peace? And that kind of shock creates a revolutionary situation which people say, you're right, we were wrong. We were shooting at each other. And what did it get us? Now we're going to have peace. And the United States has to be the sponsor of that idea and foster agreement among nations. Use the United Nations and every other asset in the book to bring nations in this region together and to foster the idea of a general development program, including economic development, for the region. The obvious thing, if you've ever flown over the Middle East, you see yellow sand, yellow sand, yellow sand. Flying, say, from Khartoum in Sudan up to Jordan, as I did one occasion. Just think of mile after mile after mile of sand, 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 from one fertilized spot, irrigated spot, to another. The Middle East can be an area of richness for the future, but we have to conquer the sand. We have to bring in water. We have to develop power. We have to develop agriculture. We have to turn wasteland into land for habitation. We should be the sponsors of that. So the minute that the President of the United States, the executive branch, says this is the policy, it all begins right there, that day, that minute. The wheels go into effect immediately. And the United States troops will stay there only to the extent that the free consent of the Iraqi people wants them there to assist in the security and reconstruction.
Then we have a question that's been submitted by a sitting member of Congress. He's a Democrat. He doesn't wish to be identified by name, which is undoubtedly part of the problem. But what he says is, he says, Mr. LaRouche, over 1 year ago, you indicated in the strongest possible terms that the ability of the United States to function in any reasonable sense in accordance with its Constitution was contingent upon the removal, one way or another, from any position of power, on the removal of Dick Cheney from any position of power. While there's been significant motion in the Congress in this regard, and while I know you have dedicated your own movement to this, I think that there are problems. I'm aware of growing discontent among uniformed military and also among the professional intelligence establishment. This week, Cheney, of course, was targeted by my fellow Democrats on the Hill, but with the exception of what I consider to be a brilliant intervention by the senior senator from New Jersey, those efforts have been largely ineffective. It seems to me that Cheney's power remains very much intact. Some say that he's stronger than ever, but I'm also aware that perception is sometimes not accurate. I'd like your assessment of the situation. Do you still believe that the removal of Cheney is an absolute necessity, and do you think that we've come any further in this fight? Also, what do you recommend for the immediate period ahead?
Well, that's a fair assessment of the way things look with respect to Cheney and respect to our situation. Now, the problem is very simple. Those in the Democratic Party in particular, let me say some things because this is we're getting someone from the Senate and the Congress, and I want to give an answer which will be useful to them for their part in this. The problem has been that the forces which are determined to keep me out of the primary debates and so forth have created the situation to which Cheney is still there. If Cheney is not removed now, it is their fault. Because if the Democratic Party had not excluded me from the debates, had not been running operations against me, we would have Cheney out now. Cheney considers me the greatest threat to his power. We have Cheney and his wife, who is actually his boss, has close associations with 10 Downing Street through a woman known as Baroness Simmons, and she certainly is barren of morality. Now, this crowd of scoundrels in 10 Downing Street who are the Blair administration, and Blair is probably not the innocent fellow traveler of Cheney, he probably is virtually his boss. We have to understand things. Now, we've gone at this, and this crowd is really coming after me. They're trying to run an international fake scandal through the British press, which they're going to bring into the United States, is scheduled to come into the United States as a dirty operation against me from a period about 2 weeks before the Democratic Convention and to continue after the convention, simply as an attempt to keep me out, because Cheney knows that if I'm not excluded, as the Democratic National Committee is causing my exclusion and others, that Cheney would be out. Because if I'm out there with the Democratic Party working with me, Cheney will be out quick. Now, let's look at another part of the thing. Let's look at the party situation. which every senior member of the Congress who's been around for a while should think about. I probably have a growing constituency among Republicans as well as Democrats. I'm not talking about just out in the field. I'm talking about leading Republicans, Republicans who are represent some degree of power in the Republican Party. What happened some time ago is you had a process under which the right wing in the United States began to take over control of the Republican Party out of the Nixon process, which Cheney and so forth represent, that continuation of that. And this was the War Party. This was the Truman Party. And many of the people who were warriors for Truman went over to the Republican Party and became neoconservative right-wingers, like Richard Pearl, Pearl Diver. The Democratic Party decided to become racist, too. This is called the Southern Strategy. This is called the Democratic Leadership Council Committee. All right, so that we have racists and right-wingers in both parties, in the Republican Party, in the Democratic Party. Now, why do we resort the parties? Why do we have a right-wing party and a non-right-wing party? I think the way you do this is not by having party conventions and reassorting the members. The way you do this traditionally in our history, we've gone through various party systems, you know. Contrary to rumor, the Democratic Party was born with Jackson, not with Jefferson. The Jefferson Party, Madison Party, died out of disgrace. And it didn't come back until a New York banker, Martin Van Buren, who was rumored to be the illegitimate son of the traitor Aaron Burr, put this guy, a racist, Andrew Jackson, on hire into the White House. So we had, in the meantime, we had the formation of the Whig Party, and the Whig Party was dissolved into the Republican Party. And, for example, me, by my family heritage, I'm a Whig. And a lot of Whigs went over to the Democratic Party. So the political tradition in the United States is such, you have elections, and the elections will sometimes cause a rescrambling of the party affiliations, as happened with Roosevelt, for example. Roosevelt's election and his presidency did involve a rescrambling of the political structures of the United States. What I'm saying to these, in response to this particular question from that source, we are going to fight this election out on a partisan basis. That's fine. But once we get the election over, and even before, apart from the election process, we have to cooperate as political figures in the country on the basis of national interest, not partisan interest. The function of partisan interest is to try to represent certain issues, certain people, certain things, but also to join with others in representing the national interest, which is the interest of the nation. Not just partisan issue. What I'm saying is we've come to a time where in the next election, if I were the president, a presidential candidate, as of now, with the present Republican administration policies, we would pull over a very significant portion of the present Republican movement to support my presidency. Do we have a kind of situation, and that I think everyone who's in the Congress knows what I'm talking about, any senior person in the Congress. We're talking about a time for a realignment of U.S. politics in accord with the interests of the American people and our role in the world. If we had competent leadership, if I were in the picture, I'm in the picture, but I'm not in the picture as far as the party's concerned. If I were in the picture as far as the party's concerned, number one, I guarantee we'd win the election. And Cheney would scamper quickly because the Republicans would throw him out, knowing that if I'm in the election, he hasn't got a chance, and they better dump him. And that's the way to go at it. The problem lies for the Democrats. They refuse to face that issue. This is not an election like the typical election. This is not going to be a monkey show like the Gore candidacy. It's what it was. It was not a serious candidacy. It was a dog and pony show. This is a time for And I guess the senator from Connecticut was the dog. This is the time when politics becomes real. Politics has to be based on policy interests of the nation, a judgment of what is good for the nation, what the nation's obligations are to itself and its role in the world. We're going to have to go through a realignment to get this right-wing thing out of us and go back to being Americans again. And the way to do it is simply is understand that. And just as Roosevelt understood that, when he had to deal with Republicans and his Congress and so forth, is when a national issue, a national interest is overriding, which is really what a presidency should be about, the executive branch of government. And under those conditions, responsible elected officials and others will work together on the basis of those issues despite other partisan divisions. They will also, as the conscience of the nation, will act together to get rid of a bad presidency without consideration about partisan interests. Get the bad president out. There are Republicans who are determined to do it. We don't consider George very serious. George is just dumb. But a George controlled by a Cheney-Schultz administration, and Schultz is the architect of this administration, is bad news. We must get that out. We must get rid of what Cheney represents, what Schultz represents. We've got to get it out of power over our country. And that is a bipartisan concern for all good, honest people. And I would hope that somehow, and I hope I'm helping that today, that people recognize that Democrats and Republicans must not be partisan to the degree that it's insane. The parties are parties. Party loyalties are party loyalties. But national loyalty comes above both.
You're listening to a live webcast from Washington, D.C. by Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche on the question of U.S. policy toward Iraq. Lynn, we have another question here. This is from an Arab diplomat who's based in Berlin, Germany. He says, Mr. LaRouche, can you please explain, how do you envision the transitional government? Will it be sovereign? If so, how can it be according to international law if it is not duly elected by the Iraqi people? Mr. Wolfowitz insists that it will not be completely sovereign. What exactly does he mean?
Well, when a country is occupied by a military force, under our law, the country is still, in a sense, a sovereign country, in the sense that we must be prepared to leave it as a sovereign country. We do nothing which interferes with the sovereignty. You've occupied the country. As I've said repeatedly, the first thing you do, as anybody in World War II was any good knew, you go to an area, you've taken over the area. What does the commander of that military unit do when they go into that area? He sends somebody out to find the mayor and the other officials who have been in office to make sure the local community functions. You don't do anything to change local government, except by law. Now, what has been done in Iraq is a travesty. The day, as has been noted by many people now, the day that Bremer came in there and dissolved the Iraqi army and fired the officials and kicked out all the Baathists was the day this country went to hell. Right? That the first thing is to go back and reverse that. Now you've got, Iraq had a constitution. Perfectly fine constitution. Okay, that constitution is recognized. No other constitution, unless a change is made by the sovereign power of the Iraqi people themselves, voluntarily, not by somebody telling them what constitution they're going to adopt. Therefore, you have a provisional government, which is arranged simply by trying to put things back into place, and you let the Iraqis themselves negotiate what the interim government will be. Now, this means, obviously, Sistani and company and other people like that will have to negotiate with people such as the Baath and so forth to form some agreement on an interim provisional government. The function of the provisional government is to prepare the way for a constitutional election of government. And what we are there for, to the extent we are there and others are there, is to try to make this process proceed as rapidly as possible. The other aspect of the process, we have a long-term problem. Iraq has been looted since the period of the first U.S.-Iraq war. It's under U.N. conditionalities. It's been looted. Children were being killed. We were starved. All kinds of horrors were imposed upon that country. If, for example, one official who has been forming the Iraqi oil minister who was speaking at my conference that I attended in Abu Dhabi, the Syed Center, pointed out that since 1977, there has been no significant improvement in the technology of oil production in Iraq. And Iraq is one of the great oil-producing areas of the world. So a lot has to be fixed. The first thing is to get a sovereign government. The first thing is to get the best approximation of a sovereign government you can get right off the deck, and that is to have a bring the people together who, under the Constitution, under the existing definition of government, constitute a provisional government for the purpose of organizing an early election to form a regular government under the Constitution. That any changes should be in the Constitution should be made by them in that process, that is, in the election of a new government, which would be responsible to call a constitutional convention to make adjustments as needed. So that's the way it should be. But we're in this process where we have to have a period of reconstruction, but we have to have the authority under which the reconstruction is done has to be established immediately. And that is to get the United States out of the position of being that authority. We then are now become, under the cover of United Nations, we become a helping hand of a group of nations in trying to put this country back together and get some peace in the region as a whole. But we are out of it. We may be in there, but we'll be in there under completely different agreement, completely different terms. Now, the key thing here also is don't forget my personal role in this. I'm the only notable political figure of the United States who has not disgraced himself in the matter of this war. This is recognized by the Iraqi people. It's recognized by the Arab world at large. I'm the only person in the United States who could be a catalyst for pulling this off. You couldn't say, well, let somebody else do what you could do. No, they couldn't do it. They don't have the respect. I have earned the respect. And the opinion of many of the Arab world, I have earned that respect. Therefore, I'm putting the respect I have earned on the line for the benefit of the people and for the benefit of the people of the United States. No one else in the United States has that respect who's in a position of leadership. And that's what will make it work. You cannot remove that factor. That's the only factor here that counts. You can't go in and say, I've got a design. Who are you? What did you do when this war started? Did you vote against it in the Congress? Did you move for the impeachment of Cheney? I did. Did you do that? Or did you say, well, maybe? No. No one in official positions in the United States has the position I have. I'm the only one that's earned the kind of respect that is required as an American representative to bring about a peace of the type required in the Middle East.
Just take your seat. We'll take questions in turn. If you have to submit a card to Ms. Vula. I should tell people here, I will begin taking questions from the audience shortly. We have a number of institutional questions that have been submitted, and I'm entertaining those questions first, and then I will move to questions from people gathered here. Lynn, this is a question that has come in from a state representative. He says, Mr. LaRouche, a growing number of constituent leaders across the United States agree with a formulation expressed by Representative Harold James when he endorsed you a couple of weeks ago. What he said then, and what I agree with, is that our constituents will have no representation or voice at the Democratic Convention unless there's a LaRouche delegation present. It's why increasing numbers of us have endorsed you. Then he says, I should also tell you that, unlike Brother James, I'm not African American, I'm white, but it doesn't change my view. While there are still enough primaries coming up to ensure the presence of a LaRouche delegation, I have to tell you that I don't think it looks good. I'm not saying that I'm about to throw in the towel. I'm not. But I am asking you for direction. What is the most effective way for state representatives like myself, for trade unionists, and for other constituent leaders to operate in the current framework?
Well, first of all, I'm a realist, but I'm also an optimist. But I believe in a policy of what is called strategic defense. The typical of this was, one of the most famous was the case of von Volkswagen, who was an in-law of Friedrich Schiller, who had studied Schiller's work on the Netherlands War, the religious war, Spanish in the Netherlands, and the 30 Years' War. And from his studies, he had devised a plan for the defense of Russia against the invasion of Napoleon's Grand Armée. And this plan was a plan of classical strategic defense, in which the emphasis was laid, and it was adopted by people, including Scharnhorst and others who were in on the picture, and more notably, others who were directly in the picture, and was adopted by Alexander I, the Tsar of Russia. Not to try to engage the Napoleonic forces with a decisive battle at the borders of Russia, but to draw Napoleon in, whether Napoleon decided to shoot Fort Petersburg or Moscow, draw him in gradually in either direction he chose, and have the destination of Petersburg or Russia waiting for him. And when Napoleon got to, by this delaying tactic, when he got to Moscow, the city was mined and ready to blow up around Napoleon in the wintertime. It blew up. And then the conserved military forces and irregular forces, volunteers of the Russian people, fell upon Napoleon's Grand Armée. And when Napoleon was in Poland waiting for the Grand Armée to retreat to Poland, Marshal Ney walked in, and Napoleon said to Marshal Ney, "Where are your troops?" The rear guard. And Marshal Ney said to Emperor, "I am your troops." There was nothing left. Now, the same thing applies in politics. When you have a situation like this, you have a war you must win on principle. What you have to do is take the defeat you're going to have to take as you take it and prepare your position so when the time comes that you'll be able to act decisively. That's what I'm doing. That's why I continue this campaign. I'm in an action which is applying to the field of politics the same action as a classic strategic defense in warfare. We have to win. We have to save this nation against the enemy, which is those forces of finance and the right wing, which are driving this nation toward destruction and toward the destruction of other nations. We must win this battle for our Constitution. I have to do it. There's no one else visible. So I must win. Because if I don't, there's not going to be left worth fighting for. So, the enemy is making a mistake. The greatest financial crisis in modern history is now coming down at an accelerating pace. A lot of foolish people, of ordinary citizens, who should have voted for me didn't. Because they weren't serious about politics. They weren't serious about the nation. They're now to find out how serious the problem is. When the American people decide that this is a serious election, they'll vote for me.
Mr. LaRouche, a small group of us who worked with Bob Rubin and Bill Clinton on the new financial architecture are sitting here listening to you. Last week, Bob was asked what he thought the impact of a new LTCM would have on the elections. He said he wasn't worried about a new LTCM. He was worried about many new LTCMs. It's time to go where nobody wants to go, it seems, in this discussion. Where do we stand in terms of the state of the global financial and economic system, and how does this impact your LaRouche doctrine?
We are talking about a global system which is in the order of tens of trillions of dollars of estimated net product per year. We are talking about financial derivatives whose annual turnover is in the order of quadrillions. This is short-term obligations. We are now entering a period of accelerating inflation of a type characteristic of hyperinflation. Now, right now. It's been accelerating for over a year. Look at food prices in grocery stores. Look at a lot of other things. We're at the point the bubbles are cracking and popping. The decision by China recently, most recently announced, is a drastic response. This is going to have chain reaction effects around the world. The system is now collapsing. The problem is that is Bob's group has to face this fact. Not when are you going to fight, but are you going to have a fighting position available to you at the time you do fight? And that's the problem. That's his problem. That's what his statement represents. He did not say, if you're not a nut, vote for LaRouche, which is what he should have said. No, he said, in this condition, there's only one man in this country who, as a candidate, knows how to deal with this problem, and he knows that. But he's not saying it, because he has other responsibilities. Well, Bob's a fine fellow. He's one of the best. I would use him in a heartbeat, I mean, just as in the presence, because he's of his competence. But he is not a political fighter of that type. I am. I've got the job. So what has to be done, there has to be a recognition of the necessity to make certain decisions. You have to have a large number of people who agreed upon that. That is what we don't have. We have me. You have a handful of people in the country, some of them who are influential, who agree with me, and who would follow me immediately if I were given support. I could pull a government today, together, today, right now. Make me president right now. I have a government. I can pull them together. I know where to get them in. Where to get them. I can staff all key positions, the executive branch, at the top level, enough to run the government. Right? So that's there. But I don't have a preparation of an accepted plan by political forces of what the action is that we're going to take. In other words, I'm prepared to do one thing. I'm prepared the instant the crisis occurs, as president, to take the kind of action that Roosevelt took on entering the White House, to put the Federal Reserve System and the banking system into receivership for reorganization and bankruptcy, and to make sure that the country functions, that it's not shut down, that we don't have bankruptcy proceedings and foreclosures that shut the country down, and to launch an immediate program in the order of probably for the first 4 years, $6 trillion of government credit to be supplied for large-scale infrastructure projects of the type we need, which would mean about 10 million additional jobs above the present net level. That's the problem. I'm prepared to do that. I'm prepared to deal with other problems of a similar nature on a global scale. I'm prepared to act now, and I know what I'm doing. But in order to act, I've got to have the political support needed for the plan of action or for the policy of a plan of action. Because when you went to the White House as president, to start to run the country as from the executive branch, you've got to know what you're doing, and you've got to have people with you who know what you're going to do. They have to think out what they're going to do in order to carry out the policies we have. Somebody has to do this and somebody has to do that. You have to have the people in place to take charge of making sure it happens. And that's what we don't have. We do not have a, we don't have a strategic fallback position where we take the defeats, we take the blows, we retreat because we're not ready. But when will we be ready, if ever? As we're going now, we will never be ready. And the crisis will come first. We don't, people don't understand our Constitution. Our Constitution is the finest instrument of its type ever seen on this planet. In a crisis, our Constitution is designed to be used as Roosevelt used it. In a crisis, to save the nation and get the rebuilding process going fast. We can do that. No other country on this planet has the constitutional ability to do that. They may do it by improvisation. Some will tend toward dictatorships to do it. We don't have to have a dictatorship. Our constitutional system enables us to do it without disturbing the Constitution in the least. You don't need to open up large camps in Guantanamo Bay or some foolish thing like that. But that's the problem, is they have to come out with me. They have to have the guts to do it. Because we lay before the American people that a bunch of people have a consensus on this issue, that we are prepared to act in recommending preparation for action. Then we can win. That's what we need.
My name is Kathleen Wynn, and I'm the co-chair of the Committee for Vote Integrity and Protection in Cleveland, Ohio. We're fighting to keep these paperless machines out of Ohio by the November election. My question is this. I agree with you on your assessment about the crisis we're now in. But how can we elect you or anybody, really, if there is a possibility that through paperless electronic voting machines in place throughout the United States, that our votes will be manipulated, that the election will be manipulated, and that our votes will never be counted accurately? Without a true and accurate count of the votes, we, the people of the United States, have absolutely no hope or power for our voices to be heard. What is your solution to this very real problem before the November election?
The conduct of an election in the United States is a matter primarily of state law. It lies generally under the supervision of the Secretary of State of that particular state. Therefore, only if the federal government has some overriding intervention, then the state is responsible. What we are pushing for, apart from what we're doing on the federal level, and there is activity on the federal level on precisely this issue, recognizing the danger. Certain faction Republicans are determined to placate the ability to have an election fraud in the order of magnitude as high as 20% of the vote by electronic voting machines, these procedures. We know it. We're out to stop them. We've been proceeding on a state-by-state level at the same time we have discussing this with relevant people in the Congress. And there is action in this direction. There's not enough. The states are actually moving much more rapidly than the federal government in terms of this time of action so far. And we're working with that. My only thing is to encourage, let's do it. That should be the policy. Let's use the authority of the state to conduct elections and force through state election procedures, which will ensure that the paper ballot with some verification procedure built into it is provided in every state. It's our best job.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to a live broadcast of an address in Washington, D.C. by Democratic pre-candidate for U.S. President Lyndon LaRouche. For those of you who are listening via the World Wide Web, you can, in fact, continue to submit questions that we will field during the course of the proceedings. What I would like to do, Lynn, is I'd like to begin to now alternate back and forth between questions from those gathered here. And as I said, we will continue to take questions via the Internet. We have Mr. King Lyon who wanted to ask a question. Mr. Lyon, why don't you come on up to the mic?
Yes. Mr. LaRouche, my interests sticking to the economics is the enormous sums of money that we're spending, particularly on the war. How will this impact, and I hope you would speak to this, how will this impact on our communities, our neighborhoods in the coming years? Because, as you know, most of our states cannot support themselves by generating the money within the states. We rely most heavily on our tax dollars coming back to our states. Do you look in the future a general raise of general taxes by the government so that we can generate this money that's surely going to be needed down the line?
Yeah, it's key. The problem is we're operating below break-even. That is, the amount of employment and income being generated in 48, at least, of the states, it's insufficient to support the state in its obligations presently. So therefore, there's only one solution, the kind of thing that Roosevelt understood, and we should understand better because of that experience. What we have to do is we have to put the entire country under financial reorganization, as using the precedent of Roosevelt. It's what I would do is a little more ambitious, but we have to do it. Then I would go by freezing the reorganizing the Federal Reserve System and putting it under federal control. You will federalize it through bankruptcy receivership, because I happen to know the leading banks of the country are bankrupt. That means the Federal Reserve System is bankrupt. Therefore, the Federal Reserve System will be put into bankruptcy. The United States will be committed immediately to a policy of return to a fixed exchange rate system for the world. And we will fight for that, and we will maintain that kind of system on our own account. Under those conditions, as I said, my plan is $6 trillion of federal newly created credit to be concentrated largely in large-scale infrastructure projects, which we need. This includes transportation, especially rail or equivalent. It means light rail, also for areas, because the highway thing is a mess. It needs power generation and distribution, water management, large-scale, rebuilding of our education and public health systems, because there's a lot of structural damage that's been done by destruction of hospitals and so forth. Government is generally efficient in funding large public works which are in this category. It is not efficient when it tries to run normal private businesses. So the way you run it is you have a banking law of the type that Roosevelt used, the way he used in part the Reconstruction Finance Corporation as an instrument for this kind of thing. Put the credit out. You move immediately with a selection of projects. Now, you do it the same way we used to use the National Highway Act. You will sometimes schedule the way you go with your construction based on the needs of a state or a part of a state, like we did some of those things. So therefore, the trick is this. We have to build up the level of net increase in employment and income, state by state, as well as the nation as a whole, such that the state now has a sufficient revenue base to balance its budget from internal income. We then have to, at the same time, make special credit available through banks, which are now coordinated by the federal government, where the local banker, under certain rules, the type we used to have back under Roosevelt, the banker will just get somebody there who's running a business or wants to run a business. And if the banker and other people in the community on this committee, advisory committee, say this person should be given the support, the credit for that business, do that too. So the point is, if we can build up a net increase of 10 million jobs in the United States, with a lot of it initially concentrated in basic economic infrastructure on the federal and state level, we can make it. This will require, for example, take the case of power generation and distribution. We used to have a system of state-regulated public utilities. They used to issue bonds. These bonds were considered almost as good as gold, almost as good as federal bonds in the old days. We destroyed that thing under deregulation. Put it back. Let the states, again, go back into the business of public utilities, state public utilities, in which federal money will come in and other money will come in to get the project going, and then you will bail out by drawing private savings into that system and run it in such a way that it's a secure investment for people who want secure investments. That kind of procedure. So it's a state and federal, largely, effort. And that's the only way it's going to work. There's nothing else that will work. we must increase the annual income of each state to the point that the income, both from wages and other income in the state, are sufficient to maintain a tax revenue base in the state, essentially, to allow the state to operate on a balanced budget. Because the states can't operate on a deficit. That's one of the problems. It should be that way, but that's one of the problems. And that's the only way that we can tackle this problem, is to get that kind of program going. Anything we try to do within the existing rules without that reform can't work. There just isn't the ability. We are bankrupt. This nation is bankrupt. And a couple of these major banks go under, everybody's going to know it. And what we're seeing now in Japan, what we're seeing in Korea, what you're seeing in cutbacks in China, which China is simply responding to rationally as a result of the situation it faces, and Europe, and here, we're bankrupt. And very soon, you're going to have chain reaction collapse of the bank. For example, take this area here. Take the housing boom, and it's going to go boom. It's about to go. The entire banking system, it's tied into this housing bubble. It's going to collapse. So we are at doomsday in terms of banking, and therefore the only thing that's going to work is a federal intervention of the type I've indicated, a Roosevelt-type intervention, which goes at the idea we're going to stop the so-called wild stuff we did in the recent years. We're going to go back to basics, basic economic infrastructure. We're talking about $6 trillion of capital investment supplied by government credit over the coming 4 years. We're talking about the need to create a net 10 million jobs. We're talking about a need to think about this in terms of how do we manage this so that each state is put back into a balance and is able to raise sufficient revenue to meet that. It means also federal programs which will absorb some of these things. For example, say the Veterans Hospital system. One of the key things we have to do as part of health care, we have to kill the HMO bill. Kill it right now. Go back to the Hill-Burton philosophy as we used to have it, which is a combination of private, public, various things. And then you took care of everyone. Somebody fell on the street, whether they had money or not, you cared for them, just as if they did. We used to have a veterans hospital system. We used to have a public health service, which was adequate. We're going to have to rebuild that, particularly when we see what's coming back from Iraq now and what's happened before. We are not even, a soldier is no longer guaranteed. A veteran who is wounded in warfare is no longer guaranteed the care, which used to be considered a right under our system. We're going to have to rebuild that. So these kinds of things will have to go forward. But essentially, it comes back to simple arithmetic. If your income, your annual income of your people and your other sources of income in the state is sufficient to carry the state as a semi-self-sufficient operation, and you do that for all 50 states, you're in pretty good condition.
Let me just say that we are getting a very large number of questions in from the internet on a very specific theme, and it's the same theme that's reflected by many of the questions that those of you here are indicating you want to ask Mr. LaRouche. And those questions center on the fact that the American people are passive, that they don't seem to be willing to be mobilized to come out and vote, and that you don't see how Mr. LaRouche can be elected if this continues to be the case. I'd like to say something on this count, because the problem is you're asking the question in a passive way. What I would say in answer, and Lynn can certainly comment on this, and I think he has commented on it in the course of his answers, is that if you want Lyndon LaRouche to be President of the United States, then you have to do something about it. The fact of the matter is that beyond anything that I think most political pundits thought possible, this campaign, uniquely through the personality of Mr. LaRouche, has successfully mobilized hundreds of young people across the United States who are right now full-time volunteers for this presidential campaign effort. These are young people who have been written off by my generation as the no future generation. Yet they have shown very clearly that they are prepared to take their own future into their hands and to work for it. What I would put forward to people who are listening to this webcast and to some of the people who are gathered here today is that if you want to see Lyndon LaRouche as President of the United States, if you want to see his policies dominate the Democratic Party, if you would like to see George Bush have the time that he needs to deal with his problems, then what you should do is very simple. If you're a young person, you should join the LaRouche Youth Movement. There isn't really anything else that you're doing right now that's more important or that can be more effective than that. And I think that it is widely recognized that the LaRouche Youth Movement, person for person, is without question the most effective political fighting force in the United States today. And I'd invite you to participate in that. If you're too old to do that, then make sure that that movement has the resources that it needs. And you can do that with financial contributions, but you can also do that by creating the environment in which those young people organize. I said that there are 500,000 copies of the LaRouche Doctrine currently in circulation. There are more being printed. 500,000 of anything in the United States is a drop in the bucket. We should be circulating tens of millions of that doctrine, and it's not a long-term project, it's an immediate project. So I would encourage you to either call into the 800 number, to contact the campaign via email, or to contact your local campaign office, and then you won't have to ask questions about the passivity of the American people. Before I take another question from the audience, I'm going to take a question from the LaRouche Youth Movement in Argentina, because I'm biased toward them. It says, Lynn, you mentioned that you enjoy the respect of the Arab community. Now, to be able to apply the LaRouche Doctrine for Southwest Asia, is it necessary for the United States to declare publicly that it has behaved in a fascist way for the last 30 years in order for it to be trusted in its future action in the region?
Well, it hasn't always acted in the fascist way the past period, but for the, it has something like that. I think I've said that fairly clearly, and therefore when people vote for me and support me, it's generally they are implying agreement with that statement. So it has been said. The support from it for that statement may be somewhat less than should have been the case. But I said it. I have documented it. I've shown it. I've said who the fascists are today, including those in Argentina and other parts of the world, the so-called Syndicus International, which is operating out of Spain and elsewhere in other parts of the world. So fascism in the United States is not a U.S. problem. It is something we imported from Europe, essentially from the British East India Company originally, which ran Europe under the Syndicus International during the period 1922 to 1945, increasingly, which almost took over Britain. Britain almost conducted an agreement with Adolf Hitler to destroy the United States. Right? 1940 was stopped, but it was almost there. So in the past period we've had in South and Central America, the fascist Nazi movement was brought in to South and Central America, partly through the courtesy of Alan Dulles and William F. Buckley, in Mexico in particular, but also through Franco Spain in various channels, and from some of the Nazis in Europe who were chopped into Uruguay and Argentina through certain dirty Vatican channels, which is a channel which is called as the Rat Line. So we have the danger of fascism is not a peculiarity of secretion of the United States. It is an international threat today, controlled by international bankers, and they're in all parts of the world. And generally, you can tell them who they are because they all, by no remarkable coincidence, happen to be my personal enemies.
Who's here in the audience. He says, Lynn, what's the role of the imitator generation, ages 25 to 40? I say imitator because for a short time, we imitated the baby boomers, but that didn't last very long. And my old comment is that a 35-year-old trying to look 21 just ain't fly. There's a split in our generation. Some of us are post-college graduates who decided to become stupid afterwards. The other group, the majority, are single parents raising two or more children. The only thing we have in common is that we're both addicted to Walmart. So what's our role?
Well, I think that's not the generation. You have two generations in there. You have an in-between generation. See, the difference is this. Look, this is an old story. There's a different twist on it, but it's an old story. The generation which is between 18 and 25 represents what? It's a historic generation. It keeps coming along. And people who are 18 to 25 generally fall into it during that period. No, but it's very important because what's the characteristic? First of all, you have emerged from childhood. You're no longer adolescent. Your emotions are different because you are a young adult. The youngest generation of actual adults. You have some people, you know, in their teens are already reaching that, but that's very rare. And then you have a certain brain deadness which tends to set in around the age of 26 and 27. This is particularly true among college professors. It is, actually. This is a phenomenon which is this, Lawrence Kuby, I used to refer to a lot to this. Lawrence Kuby did a study on the fostering of creativity. And the problem of brain deadness hitting people at about the age of 27, 28, where they would keenly repeat what they got their doctoral degree for forever, again and again and again and again. And genuine creativity would cease. When I see people today, I find creativity in young people, younger promising people, goes dead at a certain point. It's an emotional problem. I think it has something to do with the energy system or something of the person. They seem to lose energy. But the creativity, the greatest period of creativity, adult-type creativity, generally comes between the ages of 18 and 25. Now, what happens is the 18 to 25 generation comes along and finds out what they've been dumped into. And now there is an unusual situation, a situation of conflict between those in the 18 to 25 group and their parents' generation. Now, people sometimes older than 25 or older than 30 try to include themselves in that generation. They're not in it. They function differently. And they actually tend to be a deadening influence sometimes in a youth movement because they are in a slightly older age group. They don't, look, what do the youth do, 18 to 25? They will stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning conducting a dialogue, trying to thrash out and settle something that has come up that they're discussing. What happens with a person who's 10 years older? Oh, he's gone to sleep by that time. He's not there. Young people have more energy. Actually, biologically, they have more energy. And they're able to express it in ways that older people cannot. And I mean older people 10 years older can't do it. So therefore, this is, in history, a positive phenomenon. It is a positive thing to have people born to reach the age of 18 to 25 and become young adults. This is an essential part of the way history is made. History is made largely in that generation. How? It's made because history is the absorption of the experience and discoveries of previous generations into the next generation. What we're doing now with the youth movement, we are laying the foundation internationally for the next generation that will run the world. People who are now between 18 and 25 are the people who will be among those who should be running the world 25 to 40 years from now. And therefore, if you plant a certain development among people in that age group, a certain impetus, a certain start, a certain creativity, and make the breakthroughs then, that will have an impact on two generations to come. That is history. That's the way history is determined. And that's what I'm determined to do. See, you think I'm going to die? You think I'm getting old? I'm going to quit? You're crazy. I'm going to have two generations of pestering you guys, and they're going to get stronger and more capable all the time. These guys are the future. You better listen to them because they are your future. And that's the way it has to be. Those who are in an older group are actually adults. They tend to function as adults. They get into the child-rearing age, or, you know, they become soccer moms or something like that. Some other nightmarish thing. Eh? Anyway, so that's it. There is a distinction, and I don't think we should try to confuse the two. This is a very, I could do a lot more on this, but it's a very distinct generation, 18 to 25, has very distinct characteristics. It is the university age generation. It's as distinct as adolescence is distinct from pre-adolescent childhood. These are almost biologically distinct ages. And when we understand them, what their role is, we understand how to make history. What you have to do is prepare people to get into this age interval. When they get there as young adults, now they should go. They should begin to move. Develop their future role in society. Lay the foundation of the future. And we who help them, to help to steer them, should turn them loose, not try to control them. Turn them loose. Because they are going to determine the future. And they will determine the future on the basis of what we give them.
This is, before I read the next question, let me just say that this is a question from someone in the British Labour Party, Lynn. Before I read it, though, after Mr. LaRouche answers this question, as has become something of a tradition with these webcasts, because this campaign is manned and directed so much by members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, after Lynn answers this question, I'm going to turn the program over to members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, and they will continue to entertain questions. If they choose to take questions from people who are outside the 18 to 25 year old age bracket, that's their choice, but I'll leave it to them. I'm going to be asking Megan and Aaron to come up here and conduct that portion of the proceedings. But let me just ask this question first. This is Mr. LaRouche. I'm a member of the British Labour Party, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about the links of Tony Blair to the Synarchist International. Also, how would you rate Gordon Brown and other Labour ministers in regard to their inclination to defend the general welfare as Prime Minister? Do you think that Tony Blair should be ousted, as I am most ardently hoping he will be?
Well, I don't want to interfere with the internal affairs of the United Kingdom unduly. But I certainly would smile if he were to go. And I would probably invite some people to a party. With our resources, it would be a modest party. But the quality of enthusiasm would not be dampened by the shortage of money. We don't have to get drunk to enjoy things. No, people have to understand something about the British system. As I've said, the British system is an imperial system. It was developed as such in 1763 with the Treaty of Paris of 1763, which was the British victory over France and other countries, which secured to Britain the imperial status in India and over North America, or parts of North America, Canada, and so forth. So that was an empire of a company, not a monarchy. The company was the British East India Company. The British East India Company was a product of the Dutch India Company, which was brought into that form in England in 1688-89 by William Orange, the unappealing Orange. the one who killed all the Irishmen. So this group, by various manipulations, achieved imperial power with the intention of being a permanent empire in the tradition of the Roman Empire, in one sense, but based on the central principle of financier oligarchical control of a type which was Venetian model. So the Anglo-Dutch liberal model is a Venetian model. In fact, in the 18th century, the British system, the banking system, so called, was called the Venetian Party. The British East India Company was known in that century as the Anglo-Dutch Venetian Party. Now, the policy that was, and the French Revolution was the first reflection of that, the British organized the French Revolution to prevent the spread of the influence of the American Revolution into Europe. And the British policy was always then and thereafter, as it had been in the Seven Years' War, was to create such bloodshed and confusion on the continent of Europe, and by the suppression of the influence of the United States, as it was later created, to ensure that there would be no competent challenge to the British Empire's eternal rule of the planet. After 1865, when the United States had beaten the British puppet, the Confederacy, a treasonous puppet intended to destroy the United States on behalf of the British Empire, the British could no longer play those games. And in that period, the followers of successors of Lord Palmerston, who had been the key figure in organizing the Civil War in the United States, emerged as what became known as the Fabian Society. Now, the Fabian Society had such representatives as H.G. Wells, a real pig in every way. Bertrand Russell, a real fascist pig in every way. It was Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells who defined the policy of perpetual war conducted through the aid of nuclear weapons, as a weapon so horrible that people would give in to world government, otherwise empire, rather than suffer the slings and arrows of nuclear attack. This is Cheney's policy. Now, between Blair on the one side and Cheney, there are no principal differences. They may speak differently. Blair tends to speak in an excited manner. Cheney snarls and growls. But otherwise, essentially, Lynn Cheney is very close to 10 Downing Street. Dick Cheney, otherwise known as Dirty Dick, is also very close to 10 Downing Street, and they have financial deals of a very nasty nature together. So what you have here with... that's it. He got that way from chewing too many rugs. What you have is, therefore, you have a fascist alliance between the Blairs, 10 Downing Street, including the Baroness Simmons and her husband, and this crowd, who are the co-authors of the war in Iraq. There is no difference between Blair and a fascist. As a matter of fact, as anyone can tell you who looked at British history, English history, back during the 1930s, the British Union of Fascists came out of the Fabian Society. So this kind of Fabianism, this Fabian approach, which Blair represents, is the nasty. And whether Blair is more nasty than Lynn Cheney, the owner of Dick Cheney, is a question. But obviously, Blair's departure, I would look at as, well, another Hitler has gone. Because that's, in fact, what he is. It's the same kind of thing. It's a different style. The British method is different than some of the continental methods. But the question, the objective is what? The objective is to set up a world empire. And at this time, world empire of a bankrupt world will only be a fascist world empire. It won't function, actually. But the society that dies because somebody tries to make it function won't know the difference. Anyway.
Okay, at this time I'm going to ask Aaron and Megan to come up here. Again, for those of you who are listening via the World Wide Web, you're listening to a live broadcast from Washington, D.C. by pre-Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche. We will continue to entertain questions that are submitted via email by those of you who are listening. And we are, as you can probably tell if you're listening, alternating back and forth between questions from the audience that's gathered here and those of you who are still submitting your questions. Ladies, want to come up here?
Hello, my name is Erin Smith from the Baltimore local.
My name is Megan Roulard. I'm from the D.C. local. The first question is from a team of LYM organizers in Alabama. They ask, Lynn, we've been studying your doctrine and we have a few questions. Why Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Egypt particularly? Why not Saudi Arabia and or Jordan? Thank you.
This has to do with the character of the self-confidence of these states. Syria is a relatively strong state in terms of its state structure. Turkey is a very important state in the region. And particularly the Ataturk tradition is very significant because when Ataturk, the revolutionary founder of modern Turkey, who defended Turkey against the French and British influences at that time, the invasion, one of his first acts was to acknowledge the independence of Syria and saying that Turkey's borders would be limited to the borders of Turkey and would not have any aspirations for control over Arab countries, which had been, of course, the problem the Arabs had with the Ottoman Empire and others. So Turkey is crucial. Syria is crucial as an Arab state. Iran as a neighboring state of the Arab world is extremely crucial. Now, Egypt is crucial because it's the leading Arab state in terms of its influence as an Arab state. Now, if these states are together as the sponsors of an agreement, this does not mean any exclusion of any other state in the Arab sector, but quite the contrary. For example, if you go to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia would be actively concerned about its security. Saudi Arabia is fearful that the present war and the ongoing shenanigans in Iraq represent the unleashing of devils who would destroy Saudi Arabia or carve it up for the benefit of people like Cheney and things like that who are out to grab oil for their particular causes. So therefore, it would mean a meeting, essentially a convocation of Arab states with Iran and with Turkey. And also, because you have a little instability that some Americans are playing games with in Transcaucasia, it's very important that you have Armenia and Azerbaijan locked into this arrangement as a security arrangement, because that is a flank. Transcaucasia is a flank from which many troubles can come for the whole region. Therefore, you want a group of people involved, a group of nations, who can bring other nations within the region together to form some kind of a community of cooperation and security. They're all concerned with security. I'm concerned with their security. Other people are concerned with their security. The big problem is that, of course, the Israeli problem, that unless we get an Israeli-Palestinian just peace now, not some time down the line, but the kind of peace that Rabin himself wanted with the Oslo Accords, you're not going to have any peace in the Middle East. No one can bring it. Therefore, the United States must force Israel to accept the Oslo Accords. Otherwise, no peace. No possibility of peace. And that's the kind of decisions that have to be made. So therefore, no, if you get that kind of peace, that kind of arrangement, which I propose as the doctrine, I'm sure that Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and other countries would be very happy. And particularly they would be happy because they know I did it. That's the most important thing for them. They're very personal. They like to know who is doing what to them.
The next question is from Aaron Yule. Aaron, do you want to ask your question?
Hey. Yeah, I just had a question on sovereignty. How do you actually know what sovereignty? How do you know sovereignty? And when does a country become sovereign?
It's a fairly important question. The first principle of the preamble of our Constitution. The idea of sovereignty involves a mission, first of all. That is, to establish a sovereign state means that you have the mission of creating a state which is sovereign. And therefore, the condition of sovereignty is not a circumstance. It is an intention. That is, a group of people intend to have a sovereign state. Now, what goes into that then is the effect of realizing that intention or attempting to do so. And this is something I spend a good deal of time writing about and dealing with otherwise. That people will say, why not have world government? Why not eliminate the nation state? Why not have globalization everywhere? Or globularization, probably a better term. Because that the communication of ideas, which uses language in part, cannot be accomplished by carrying a dictionary around with you. That what is involved in a culture is not a dictionary of words, or inventing a synthetic language is the worst idea of all. This Esperanto is a crazy idea. That in what is involved with the language is history. That in all important communications, you use words in a way you could never find in a dictionary. It's called irony. You take words which usually have one association, as its common association, but you put them together in a certain way, and you create an idea which is nowhere in the dictionary. Now, these ideas are shaped by two things, by history, the transmission of historical experience from one generation to the next, and also by the innovation, discoveries of new principles. The most important thing, for example, one of the problems we have in the United States today, we have almost no culture because we have no music and no poetry. What is called music today, popular music, is not music. What is called poetry is not poetry, because it does not have the qualities of classical poetry which enable you to define meaningful new concepts, just like the discovery of a scientific principle, by juxtaposing words in a new way so that other people know, recognize the idea you're trying to express. In the history of languages, what used to be called classical poetry, this is an example, one I refer to often because I have some experience with some scholars on this, was Tulloch's observation that the Vedic poetry, which was transmitted into Sanskrit and beyond from Central Asia, contained precise astronomical information in the poems which enabled the scholars to ascertain exactly at what time these poems had been written by the astronomical content of the poems. And these were transmitted largely by oral transmission, not by written form, orally. They were transmitted in a form of musicality which is specific to the Vedic Sanskrit tradition, such that even, as this Professor Dandekar indicated to me in Pune, that even to the present day you have chanters who chant hymns, Hindu hymns, which come from the Vedic and are in the Sanskrit. But the singers of these chants, which are part of the religious service, don't know the language. They never learned the language. Nonetheless, these poems were transmitted by oral tradition, or largely oral tradition, over thousands of years. and the information in them pertaining to astronomical data remains valid to the present day. Now, only classical poetry can do that. And in English classical poetry, the great examples of it show the same principle. The use of the bel canto method, which is the Italian bel canto, Florentine bel canto, reveals in the application to music, to classical music, in song form, exactly how this works. So therefore, the way that a language functions and a culture functions, and language is, of course, the center of culture, is not in the dictionary meaning of words, but it's rather in the process of transmission of old and new ideas for which no dictionary word exists, which is nonetheless clear to the hearer, or is accessible clearly to the hearer. And this coincides with the experience of the people, family experiences over successive generations, all of these things that go together. So once a people has the intention of forming a nation state, one of the best examples of this is our nation state. We are a melting pot nation. We are the most typically melting pot nation on this planet, contrary to some races and bigots. We have no race. There is no race. There's only the human race, except for some bigots who have some stupid other idea. We're all the same. We have formed a nation around an intention. We have used the English language, which is not the way it's used in England, is partly the way it's used in Ireland. We use the English language as a medium for a melting pot culture of our nation. We have traces of other languages in the use of the English language. We have our own unique uses of the English language. But we have formed an American culture, which is different than the culture of any other part of the world, around the intention to have a sovereign republic. And therefore, the protection and maintenance of that intention is the concept of sovereignty, along with the constitutional principles around which we built the nation.
This is another question from the youth movement in Argentina. This is coming from a group in Neuquén, in the Patagonia. At the National University of Comahue, they're following this event with a big screen like this one. Emiliano is asking specific questions as they pertain to the larger issue of national sovereignty. He explains, the Neuquén province is very rich in energetic resources, hydroelectric plants, oil, gas, uranium, water for nuclear plants, drinkable water as well. We had for decades a lot of state companies that supported life and progress of the nation. Then the companies were sold to private hands, which he then lists. This province and the neighboring provinces are pushing for something called regionalization to get more power and freedom to deal with foreign companies. Some people are talking about total independence from the nation, like a new country. He then asks, do we have a future of the development of our living conditions with the energy and natural resources in foreign private hands?
Yes, this is something I know something about. There has been, for some time, coming out of the fascist tradition in Spain, the Franco-fascist tradition, and before that, the Carlist tradition in Spain, a people who have never given up restoring some kind of monarchy, that the argument that the nations which were formerly the colonies of Brazil and Spain, that is, the colonies of the Iberian Peninsula, have never lost their status as being property of Spain. And therefore, the intent was, a movement was built around the fascist nucleus and around certain European bankers to take over by various methods, including fascist movements, to take over the territory of the former Spanish and Portuguese colonies from the Rio Grande in the United States all the way down to Antarctica. That was the intention. The key manifestation of economic manifestation of this policy today in those countries is the takeover of the energy and related resources of the continent more and more by Spanish financial front interests. And what is happening is exactly that. Now, these people happen to be, the people behind this in Spain and elsewhere, happen to be Senecas, i.e. fascists. These Senecas have in effect declared war against the United States and civilization, pretty much as if Hitler had come back with a Spanish mustache. Therefore, since what is going on financially is international predatory interests, which are acting contrary to moral law, to natural law, and since these institutions are essentially bankrupt, we have to act with the initiative of the United States to restore Argentina in particular to the condition of being a sovereign nation. That means that we will examine the books of these countries of South and Central America. We'll go back in particular to 1971-72, when the floating exchange rate system was put into effect. We're going to look at the books, look what the IMF did and the World Bank did under the floating exchange rate system, which I happen to know to be a swindle. Therefore, we're going to say every debt which was not paid in but was imposed or derived from impositions made artificially by the IMF and World Bank, those will be canceled. Now, that will effectively bankrupt a lot of the people who've taken over these properties of Central and South America. And if I'm president of the United States, these countries are going to be very happy, at least the good people in them, because we are going to encourage their sovereignty. This has been our policy ever since the Monroe Doctrine, 1823. What do? Well, do what we do. Become part of our system. Become part of our recreation of a Bretton Woods-type system. Under this, create credit. Take over your own natural resources. Create your own companies, which are yours, not those of lying, thieving predators who don't deserve anything, who stole it. Rebuild it. Now, the area of Patagonia happens to be, as I know because we did some studies some years ago about this thing, potentially one of the richest areas on this planet for habitation, for development. Tremendous, untapped potential. You could have a lot of people there, rather happy people in a short period of time, in agriculture, industry, mining. It has great resources. Why should we let it go to waste? Be assured, if I become president of the United States, this is going to be fixed.
The next question is from the Detroit LaRouche Youth Movement. The question is, how does one know another's intention? Because this seems to be something that is relevant to relations between countries and people getting to know and trust another's judgment and ideas and one's own.
Well, some things are easier than others. And the trick in, I think, in diplomacy and law, nation building, is to start from what you can agree upon. And if hope that that is sufficient to get you through the immediate challenge ahead, and then to go on and on the basis of success in dealing with that point of agreement, to look for ways of broadening your areas of agreement. It's the same thing like life in general. It's like science or everything in general. We don't know everything. At no time do we know everything. We are constantly discovering new principles of the universe. We didn't know everything. What we should do is always proceed from what we do know, particularly what we can settle is a matter of principle. Proceed from that. Be satisfied that we don't know the answer to everything. And don't fight about what we don't know the answer to. but rather discover what the answer is. And there is plenty of agreement among nations. There's enough room for agreement, which is clear, that we should have no trouble in getting along together and cooperating. But if we want to, for example, if you want to raise some kind of religious question, well, we have this religious difference, let's fight about it. No, we're not going to fight about it. We don't allow that. We can't do that. We're not going to fight. You want to have it? You want to believe that? That's your business. We're not going to fight about it. We'll have our own. But there are some things we do know. There's some things that government can know and does know. And government should limit itself to those things which it can know, which you can agree upon. And you have to be content with that. You have to discuss the rest. You have to explore the rest, as we do in science. But operate on what we should know, we should be able to agree upon already. And find in our cooperation on that a basis for continued cooperation, and hope it expands. And you know how you do that? Again, children and youth. The great integrators of nations are children. Children from all parts of the country, world, brought together, will tend to play together. If you want to bring a people, you know, it used to be the case of immigrant families in the United States. We used to have a lot of immigrants. We were very happy about it. We were very proud of that at one time. Huh? How would the immigrant families come together from different parts of Europe? They came together because the children played together. Yeah? So the other thing is, how does society develop? It develops on an adult level largely through the initiative of the 18 to 25 generation. The children and adolescents play together. The 18 to 25 are the leading edge, the university age group. What we have to do is recognize, we have to develop the economies of the world so that we can provide what I consider a competent education on the university level for every person. Because people in the 18-25 age level need the opportunity to develop those powers. And to the extent that we do that and continue to utilize the fact that young people, children and other young people, will bring people of different backgrounds together as a people. Go one step further. Why do we neglect those in the 18-25? Why don't we have a decent form of higher education guaranteed for all persons, so we do a better job of integrating nations and cooperation on the basis of the most advanced level of scientific and related culture, instead of limiting it to a few people and giving half-baked education as college education in order to keep people quiet?
The next question is from Brian McAndrews from the Philadelphia Youth Movement.
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about the DNC. Because I just participated in the Pennsylvania primary, where we had some not so insignificant members of the Democratic Party there who endorsed you for president and had organized and mobilized a significant portion of the Democratic Party of Philadelphia to vote for you. And we found out afterwards, or the day of the election and after, there was a significant number of sandbagging and counter-organizing, obviously coming from high levels of the Democratic Party to keep you from getting delegates. Now, this is a question I have about the DNC specifically, because it was created in 1848 to manage, I guess, party affairs between elections and things. And I also know that they opposed Roosevelt in his candidacy or counter-organized against him. So I don't know, what productive role has this ever played in the Democratic Party? It's not the Democratic Party. It the people, the members of the Democratic Party are the party. So why does it continue to exist and operate seemingly as a completely nasty thing within the party? And why do people go along with it?
Well, first of all, you have to destroy the myth of the Jefferson-Jackson session. the idea of the Jefferson Jackson Democratic Party. It doesn't exist. It never did. You had the Democratic Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson and Madison, which managed two presidencies of two terms each. And they fell in disgrace. And a new party began to emerge, which became the Whig Party, as a replacement. Now then, in the 1820s, you had a New York banker who was a treasonous thug, Martin Van Buren, later a president, who put in a hired thug, Andrew Jackson, as president. Now, the purpose of doing this on the part of Van Buren was to destroy the Bank of the United States, which Jackson did. What he put in was a system of land banks, which was a vast John Law-type swindle. This went down in 1837 and bankrupted and ruined the economy of the United States. This guy was a British agent, Van Buren. What they were doing is they were operating at that time to try to divide the United States into two groups, using the slavery and free trade issues as crucial. And from that time up until Roosevelt's time, the Democratic Party was a party of filth, which managed to pick up a certain amount of votes, particularly from so-called immigrant groups, but it was nonetheless operated with the same intention. It was always controlled by British bankers or British-controlled bankers from New York City. Then you had a problem, because the Republican Party, which had been created actually in opposition to this aspect of the Democratic Party, under the New York bankers became just as dirty as the Democrats. And this went on until Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt was out to destroy this machine. He knew what there was. Franklin Roosevelt was a follower of, guess whom? Of Isaac Roosevelt, was an ally of Alexander Hamilton for national banking. So Roosevelt changed the Democratic Party at a time that both the Democratic Party and Republican Party had become pretty much of a stinking mess, and the Democratic Party by tradition. What built the Democratic Party today as a party, the positive aspect, was Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt saved the United States and the world. He saved the United States from a depression, and his role saved the world from world conquest by the forces behind Hitler, without which we would be living under, or not living under, something like Hitler today. They're still trying to bring back. That's the issue. The problem is that we have not had political movements which have had the strength and continuity needed to build a healthy party system inside the United States, one that lives up, meets level, up to the level of the standard of our Constitution. We don't have it. The way it's done is they play upon small-mindedness of our people. They always go to sets of the population and say, I am concerned about my community. I've got to think about my family interests. Don't involve me in national politics. And if you don't control national politics, you don't control anything. If you don't control the politics of the nation as a whole, you don't control anything. You're not going to solve anything on a local level. But they play this small-mindedness, just as this thing, famous passage of Cassius from Julius Caesar, where Cassius says to Brutus, the problem is we are underlings. And the way the American people are corrupted is they are told, be an underling. Think of your local community. Think of your local family interests. Think of your special interests. Think of your competitors. You want government to help you against this guy you're competing with. And you play upon that pettiness, that stupidity, that stinking stupidity of our people. And you turn them into acting like pigs, dogs to each other. Therefore, you divide them around these kinds of petty issues of my local this, my local thing. If you have a country that takes care of everybody, what do you got to fight about on your local issues? Nothing. Well, so therefore, by getting the population dragged down. For example, today, so-called wedge issues, single issuism. Single issuism is a typification of moral corruption in the extreme. Someone says, oh, I'm a moral person, therefore I'm for these single issues. Say, you're an immoral person because you're for single issues. That is the ultimate immorality. You don't care about the rest of the world. You're willing to let the world go to hell as long as your little single issue is supported. You don't have any universal issues. Man is supposed to be universal, a universal creature, not divided by race, but a universal creature. We're the only immortal creature in the universe. We're the only thing which it transmits something which is immortal from ourselves to coming generations, which acquires something which is immortal from previous generations, which is part of us. We are part of humanity. We have an intention to be a nation. These are the things which should concern us. Other things will tend to take care of themselves if we take care of the things which are universal. And the problem is they make us small. And single issues and wedge issues and things like that are used to divide us. Section was always the problem in the United States. Section in the 19th century. We were played by money issues. You can get a little more money, steal, cheat, get a little more money for yourself. And that's the problem. And I think these kinds of changes that are needed come only when populations, some come so close to extinction that they look up to the sky and they say, what did we do wrong? Let's stop doing whatever it is. And maybe the people of the United States will be frightened enough by what they have brought upon themselves, by the way they've played politics, by the way they've allowed themselves to be manipulated by wedge issues, they will say, we've got to cut it out. That's the only chance we have.
The next question is from Stan from the New Jersey Youth. Stan, do you want to ask your first question yourself? You want me to read it? Okay. Mr. LaRouche, my first question is directed towards the idea of nation-state serenity. You go into the history of modern state civilization around the period of the Renaissance. How can other cultures come to understand the universal principle that governs the idea of serenity? Sovereignty, especially with the, is it say governments? Governments of Africa, where the idea of neocolonialism was substituted for the so-called republics.
Well, there's a principle which is probably most exquisitely stated by Percy Shelley in an essay, famous essay of his, on In Defense of Poetry, which I've often referred to. It's played a very important part in my life because it steered me in certain directions at a certain point. And in the course of a toward conclusion, after going through many aspects of this matter, he said there are certain periods in which there is a heightened sense, power of insight into universal principles. And it's a passion, not incomprehension, of matters of mankind. And he characterized this kind of period as a period of fluorescence of poetry. That there are periods of what you call renaissances or things like that, in which are people coming through a bad experience and having a vision of an alternative to that bad experience becomes enthusiastic, as the youth movement today show that kind of potential for being part of a renaissance, saying the baby boomer generation has failed. Society is going to hell, the whole thing is disintegrating unless we change things. We youth, we're discussing this, maybe by together we can do something to change this. That is the typical situation in history of a Renaissance. This kind of period results in impassioned developments around ideas of science, ideas of society. It tends to be a period of proliferation of classical forms of poetry, things like that, of new kinds of expression. And in that period, a people which seems to be hopeless, incapable of solving anything, suddenly becomes effective in the way that we have with these so-called periods of Renaissance in history. The way these problems have to be dealt with, to put Africa as one special case, they have to be dealt with that way. That anyone in my position who knows what I know says what we need is a Renaissance. And my approach is, how do we build one? And you say, you always start with the youth movement. If there's one available, you build it, encourage it. That's how a Renaissance started. Look at the age interval of when people came into the movement that became the formation of the American Republic. How old were they? How old was Lafayette when he became a general of the Army of the United States? How old was Hamilton when he became a leading figure of the U.S. military in the defense of the United States? These were the age of the 18 to 25s. With a couple of old folks like Franklin, like me, and some younger people, younger, older men like Washington. But it was the youth of this age group that did it. This was a Renaissance in the United States which shook Europe and shook the world. You had a similar movement. How old was Lessing when he and Moses Mendelssohn made a revolution in Germany in terms of classical knowledge and science? The same kind of thing. And that's how you do it. Now, in the case of Africa, there is no general solution, because Africa is now being murdered by genocide. The genocide comes largely from the British, from the United States, and from Israel. Those are the three parties who are the greatest sources of evil in Africa. What is going on in sub-Saharan Africa is genocide, pure genocide, nothing else. Deliberate genocide, spelled out precisely by Henry Kissinger in 1974 in a memorandum, National Security Study Memorandum 200. The Africans are sitting on top of natural resources. We want those resources for our future. We can't let the Africans use them up. We must prevent them from increasing their population because they'll use up natural resources. Above all, we must prevent them from developing technology, because then per capita they will use too much natural resources, which we want for our future. This policy was put into place also by Zbigniew Brzezinski. Global 2000, global futures. This policy was a policy of creating the environmentalist movement, the greening movement, the anti-nuclear movement, were all created for the same purpose. But in the case of Africa, this meant die. How do you get people to die? You get them to kill each other. And what is going on in Africa today is genocide. And nobody can do anything about it unless the United States does something about it. And Clinton didn't have the guts to take on the forces he knew were responsible. And nobody else would really do anything about it except a few missionaries and a few people like that. So you didn't have the conditions under which you could create optimism in Africa. Africa is besieged by the pessimism which is brought upon it by these kinds of conditions. A sense of hopelessness, a sense of going backward, ever backward. So we have to create a renaissance among ourselves, sufficient to take over Africa policy and end this genocide. Identify the sources of it. Identify the mechanisms. Uproot the institutions, the international institutions which are guilty. And then, and only then, will people in sub-Saharan Africa believe that there is any hope for the future of their people. So yes, we have one solution for ourselves. for Europe. There are certain things we can do. But we have a basis for optimism. But look at the condition of Africa, especially since the 1970s, since the middle of the 1970s. Africa has been subjected by the United States, by Britain, and by Israeli intervention into genocide. Who created Museveni? Who created the genocide in the Great Lakes area? It was the Israelis, the British, and the United States. Yes, there were French involvements too, but those were the principal ones. And therefore, unless we are willing to remove that, we have no reason to complain about the condition we lament in Africa. And also, I don't like this African-American thing. I don't like the language. I don't like the very term. I guess you could say Americans of African descent. That's a good term. It's a fair term. But most people called Afro-Americans have no sense of what Africa is. How can they be Afro-Americans? They're not. They're Americans. Why play into the racists who want a nice category like Afro-American that can be targeted for genocide and other kinds of things? They're all Americans, maybe of African descent, but they don't know anything, really, about Africa. They ask me to find out what's going on in Africa. I know more than they do. Maybe I'm an African-American.
This is a question from the youth movement in Mainz, Germany, and this is going to be the last question. Hi, Lynn. Here in Europe, people have difficulties in differing truth from mass opinion. How can you recognize truth? Which quality should a world leader else have? Thank you, from Alexandru.
Well, truth is truth. The problem is that people don't know what truth is. And they haven't decided to tell the truth yet. They've decided to express opinion. And what we are in the United States today. You know what we are? We are sophists. You know what a sophist is? Athens, and in the time that Pericles came to power, was the most advanced political institution in the world. And it, what did it do? It destroyed itself. At the end of certain wars, it went over under Pericles into a form of corruption which is called sophistry. There is no truth, there is only opinion. And under this sophistry, they declared an attack on the island of Melos, one of Athens' allies, and committed a kind of genocide against the people who refused to submit to Athens' terms. This led to what we call the Peloponnesian War, from which Athens never fully recovered. Now, the disease that killed Athens was sophistry. The typical example of sophistry was the trial and judicial murder of Socrates by the so-called Democratic Party of Athens. It was the Democratic Party again. I do it all the time. In response to this situation, Plato did a number of things, but composed a series of dialogues, the Socratic dialogues, which are actually a form of drama. And they can only be understood if you think of them as classical drama. Think of, you know, read them in school and so forth. No, that's that you don't know anything then. You have to experience a Socratic dialogue in its form as a classical drama. And you have to experience them all, not pick pieces out of it. The whole thing is a package. Because the package is a treatment of a subject of statecraft and the subject of truth. So in terms of European civilization, we have probably the only efficient standard of truthfulness which exists in the world. And that is the Platonic Socratic standard of truthfulness. Now, what we've done in the United States in order to destroy this, because remember, we were a reflection, in our Constitution was a reflection of the Platonic tradition. We used to refer to Solon of Athens, who laid down the principles on which the United States Constitution was, in a sense, modeled. we look to that period of the greatness of ancient Greece, the greatness of Athens in that period, its best traditions, not Pisistratus, the super democrat. The super democrats were always trouble. Those who were men of principle rather than men of opinion were important. We look back to that. That was our. So we should just go back to that and recognize when someone says you've got to go by popular opinion, that you have to do what the polls tell you. Not you, instead of having you personally are responsible to tell the truth. It's your personal responsibility. That's a truthful society, including the truth about yourself. And don't borrow somebody else's opinion. You have a policy in the United States was opinion. This came in the post-war period. There is no truth, there is only opinion. That is sophistry. We can do what we call it today, spin. Spin. You don't call them liars, you call them spin doctors. They advise candidacies. And people say, well, I can't speak until I talk to my spin doctor. It's Kerry's problem. Kerry doesn't tell the truth. He's got a bunch of spin doctors. And he looks like a guy who's sitting inside a tumbler inside a washing machine. He's spun and spun and spun. And he comes out rather bruised and incoherent. No, we need truth. But we have a standard of truth. We have a standard of scientific truth. We have a standard of a poetic truth, of truthfulness in poetry and drama, classical drama. We have all these things. One of my missions in life, among my many missions in life, is to fight always to try to get people a sense of this principle of truthfulness. What do we know and what don't we know? And let's fight about what we do know and fight for what we should know. Don't worry about all these things, these opinions. We have too much opinion and not enough knowledge. Thank you.
You've been listening to a broadcast of a live event from Washington, D.C. The speaker has been Democratic presidential pre-candidate Lyndon LaRouche. To those of you who have been listening from outside the United States, particularly to those of you in the Arab world, I'd like to tell you that Mr. LaRouche is currently working approximately 100 hours per week, assisted by a movement with admittedly limited resources, but with infinite energy and commitment. And we're determined to restore the United States to a policy that's coherent with this nation's founding principles through Mr. LaRouche's presidential campaign. So I would say to you today that you should not lose heart. To my fellow Americans, both young and old, although the hour is indeed late, the good news is that there's still plenty of time for you to get off your asses and to answer Mr. LaRouche's call for you to come out and help him in this drive. Our technical staff keeps telling me that we don't have any wiggle room, and I in the beginning I thought they were talking about the size of my butt, but I now realize they're talking about the schedule. So we're going to wrap up. For those of you who submitted questions that were not asked, we will actually give those questions to Mr. LaRouche, and as we always do, and he will answer them in time. So I'd ask you to be patient for your answer if your questions were not already answered. Otherwise, you've been an excellent audience. I would ask you to join with me in thanking Mr. LaRouche for his time and for his extraordinary efforts in this presidential campaign.
Thank you, guys. Thank you all.